Professor Richardson is professor of sociology and judicial study at University of Nevada. He is director of Ground Soil Center for Justice Study, and he directs MA and PhD program in judicial studies. He was president of Association for the Sociology of Religion and president of the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion. He travels a lot. We know him well. He knows very well the situation in the United States, but also in Europe. And I'm very pleased he will give us a lecture. Please, Jim.
Thank you. I think I'll stand and try to stay out of the way. I decided to do a PowerPoint. I hope that's all right. And I hope those of you with vision like mine will probably need to come to the front. We'll see how it goes. If you're interested, I'd be happy to send you this PowerPoint. It's partially written as a paper, but if the PowerPoint interests you, let me know and I will send it to you as an attachment. I've been very interested over the years in how and why do courts manage religion. Obviously, courts do manage religion. How they do it is very fascinating to me. And why they do it is the question that I've become more interested in of late. A few of you were present when I delivered my presidential address to the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion entitled Managing Religion and the Judicialization of Religious Freedom. In that paper, I developed some of my ideas focused on how modern Western societies manage religion in this increasingly pluralistic world. And I proposed, as a tentative hypothesis, that there's a seeming trend to offer more protection for religion in the modern world. And for those of you who would be interested, you can, of course, read the paper and see how I developed the argument. I had a special focus on the judiciary, and I used the phrase out of political science, the judicialization of politics, as a beginning point for looking at that issue. We'll talk more about that as we proceed, but if that term is new to you, you may want to Google it sometime and find out what the political scientists are saying. In this paper, I reported on religion cases in the New Europe and on the role of the European Court of Human Rights particularly, as well as developments within the United States and other nations that offered support for my tentative thesis. But I'm happy to say that I did offer some important caveats at the end. Particularly, courts are having trouble, just as executive branches and legislative branches are having trouble dealing with Islam. And we'll talk, as time allows, about that some. In this paper, footnote 34, I'm sure all of you are familiar with that footnote, I made a mention of the notion of partners, that courts require partners in order to accomplish their will as they go about taking care of their responsibilities, including responsibilities in the area of human rights and particularly religion. I'm going to offer a theoretical approach that's somewhat sociological. I am a sociologist after all. I'm going to suggest, building on trying to explain that footnote and develop the theme, that courts sometimes have or seek partners in order to accomplish possible goals and agendas. I cite the 215 paper we just mentioned, but I would particularly recommend to you Wojciech Sardorski's 2009 paper, where he talks about cooperation between constitutional courts and the European Court of Human Rights as a very important kind of partnership with many implications. Courts can have partnerships with other courts, particularly in hierarchical court systems like in the United States and many other countries. You do see these partnerships defined by law or constitution. In non-hierarchical regional court systems, the European Court of Human Rights being one good example, they do not have formal jurisdiction, but as Sardorski and some others have noted, that kind of jurisdiction seems to be developing in ways we'll hopefully talk about. But an important aspect of the notion of partnership that I want to talk about today is that courts sometimes partner with plaintiffs who bring legal actions to the court. This is established by the court accepting cases to adjudicate. In the United States, the Supreme Court decides which cases it wants to adjudicate and decides most of the time not to accept the case. So when it does accept a case to adjudicate, it's an indication that they must view this as an important issue. To do this, of course, requires that the cases be submitted for adjudication. Continuing this, I want to propose from the sociology of law an interesting party of third-party theory of third-party partisans that sociologist Donald Black and a student of his, Baumgartner, proposed in 1999. They raised a question. I don't know if any of you or many of you are familiar with the work of Donald Black. He's a preeminent sociology of law theorist in America, explaining how courts work, how the legal system works, and who usually wins and who usually loses. The problem with that, of course, is that sometimes people win, or parties win, that were not expected to win. He calls them weak litigants, and when that does happen, it requires explanation. So they develop the theory that some weak litigants who have little status and no connection with the court, with the decision makers in society, when they win, it probably means that they have found some allies to help them. Sometimes in the American adversarial context, it's simply finding the resources to hire a very good and prominent attorney. But if you've got a group like the American Civil Liberties Union on your side or other groups, then that increases the odds that you might win. They talk about the strange attractor phenomenon and suggest that it needs more research, and I would certainly agree with that. Why is it that certain plaintiffs will attract high status persons or entities to defend their cause? I make the controversial point here and elsewhere that sometimes the courts themselves may function as third-party partisans in favor of certain plaintiffs and causes as they implement the agenda of the court, whatever it might be. That's a pretty controversial point to make. It's suggesting that the courts have biases. I'm sure that won't surprise many of you to suggest that, but the idea of fitted into this theoretical scheme may be new to you. The court's agenda may be an expansion of religious freedom and other goals, but it also may simply be an expansion of the purview and authority of the court. They may want to make a point about something or extend their authority, such as in the United States when the Bill of Rights was first promulgated, it only applied to the federal government, and then in the middle of starting in the 1930s, and then particularly over the next couple of decades, the Supreme Court said that all 10 items, not all 10, but most of the items in the Bill of Rights did cover states and local governments. And sometimes they did that, as we'll see, using religious groups and those cases as a vehicle. Now, the lawyer side of me comes out, and I want to talk a little bit about jurisprudential theories that have developed at the European Court of Human Rights, or developed to try to explain what the European Court of Human Rights has been doing since the breakup of the Soviet Union. I'm sure most of you will know that the Council of Europe was a relatively small and homogeneous group initially, and then with the breakup of the Soviet Union, many different nations sought membership and brought their culture, their history, their problems, if you please, with them into the purview of the Council of Europe and the European Court of Human Rights. The initial understanding of how nations manage religion prior to the breakup of the Soviet Union is simply to say that the individual countries could decide what to do. The margin of what's called the margin of appreciation was the dominant doctrine, and very seldom did the European Court of Human Rights accept any case with religious implications. After that, I should have said more about the first point. There are those, and I'm one of them, who initially said this, along with others, of course, that the European Court of Human Rights, after the Council of Europe expanded dramatically in the 90s, started using a double standard and more harshly dealing with newer nations from Central and Eastern Europe in their decisions. And you can see a pattern. That's the first thing that jumps out if you look, if you list all of the decisions that, for instance, that deal with Article 9, the religion provision in the convention, then you see that most of those decisions come from newer nations in the Council of Europe. But some other scholars, Carolyn Evans and Lech Berlicki, for instance, a former judge on the European Court, have suggested that the easiest way to explain what the European Court of Human Rights is doing in their decision making is that they're at least protecting the right of religious organizations to exist and function, that they're not particularly interested in individual religious freedom. And some evidence for that exists if you look at all the cases about veils and headgear and things of that nature that come out of the original countries such as France. They don't admit them. They decide not to adjudicate them until recently, that is. There's also an interesting jurisprudential theory that the European Court of Human Rights favors a neutral, secular approach that implicitly, some would say explicitly, supports a Christian view of the world that is anti-Muslim in its application. I won't be able to develop that point very much today in the time I have, but the fuller paper, I intend to expand it and discuss some cases that may support that kind of theory. There's some key assumptions I want to quickly mention that undergird any effort to talk about the judicialization of politics and the judicialization of religious freedom. Court systems must have some degree of independence and autonomy if they're able to establish these partnerships that I've talked about with other courts and with potential plaintiffs. The judicialization of politics idea developed out of situations in societies where court systems were left to make the tough decisions. Conflicts between the executive branch and the legislative branch couldn't resolve an issue, so they said, we'll let the courts decide it. We're very used to that in the United States now, that part of the Senate and the House can't agree with the executive branch and haven't agreed for 8 years. So many very important decisions have been made by the United States Supreme Court. They're kind of running the country. And in the 1990s, we saw that in Hungary, where the Constitutional Court was basically running the country. By suggesting this, that courts form, another assumption is that if courts are forced to form partnerships with political regimes, the military, or a dominant church in order to survive, they simply can't function effectively and protect basic human and civil rights. Let's talk briefly about higher courts partnering with lower courts and hierarchical systems. The partnering is, like in the American system and in many other countries, it's obligatory because of the law or the Constitution that says there's a high court, a Supreme Court, and they can make decisions that have precedential value that are binding on the lower courts. But an interesting thing can develop in these hierarchical systems where the higher courts may actually welcome decisions from lower courts and accept cases to adjudicate because they want to establish a precedent or even overrule a previous decision they made. The most striking example of that is what happened with the Jehovah's Witnesses in the 40s in the United States. The Gobitis decision, basically the Supreme Court said that it was all right to force Jehovah's Witness children to salute the flag. That led to what might be called a lot of chaos or even riots, where Jehovah's Witness parents were attacked, children were attacked, they were kicked out of schools. Some children were taken away from witness parents. The court got the message that something had gone badly awry, and they actually invited another case. About a year later, in a decision, they included a sentence that said, we'd like to look at this again, so they accepted a case, the Barnett decision, and 3 years later, they totally reversed themselves. and said that witness children had freedom of expression, freedom of religion, and didn't have to salute the flag. And that calmed things down considerably. So hierarchically organized court systems can do that sort of thing and change what the law is fairly rapidly if they want to. There's a caution here. Conflicts can develop when constitutional courts are established outside these normal hierarchical systems. And this has happened in virtually all of the former Soviet countries that came into the Council of Europe. There are those who think that it was actually an unwritten assumption that you would, in fact, establish a constitutional court to protect human and civil rights. If you do that, we'll consider letting you in the Council of Europe. That's a debatable point, but it's an interesting pattern that developed where a non-elected court system was basically implicitly, if not explicitly, required in order for these nations to join the Council of Europe. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the European Court of Human Rights, one of the instruments to which our first speaker discussed. The court is the judicial arm of the Council of Europe. It does not have a formal jurisdiction over national courts and has little formalized ability to enforce its decisions. They're finding that out the tough way with some countries, particularly countries like Russia. A nation can be expelled from the Council of Europe, but that hasn't happened. It could be expelled over refusal to agree to the decisions. I would suggest, as Sardusky does, that in recent decades, the court is acting more and more as the head of a hierarchical system, and it's doing it using a concept called private judgments. I'm sure some of you are familiar with that term. It's a term Sardusky uses, but it also appears in a number of decisions of the court in recent years. They're basically saying we're making a judgment, and this should guide the nations in developing law in this area. And I would suggest to you, by the way, I've discussed this a bit with Sardusky. He's a Polish legal scholar who spends a good bit of his time at the University of Sydney in the law school there, and I visited with him. He's not sure that he agrees with me, but I would suggest that the Kokkinakis case sent a tremendous message. It's the first violation of Article 9 found in over 40 years. Before that, they just didn't admit any of those cases. But then in 1993, in a propitious bit of timing, they sent a message to the world that we're going to start enforcing Article 9. And since then, there have been dozens of Article 9 cases decided, most of them from former Soviet-dominated countries. I keep hitting the wrong button here. The European Court of Human Rights has also partnered with some constitutional courts to support their decisions. Sardusky, in his 2009 article, actually talks about a series of cases having to do with rent control from Poland, where there was back and forth. It actually went to the court several times. The court made several decisions. Poland finally got it right, and so they dismissed the case. They just considered it a friendly settlement. But there are other examples of this happening. Some of you are aware that that Russia has lost six major cases involving minority religions before the European Court of Human Rights. Unanimous, strongly worded decisions, even saying that Scientology has a right to exist and be re-registered and that kind of thing. Salvation Army, Jehovah's Witnesses, and other groups. And in those decisions, usually they were quoting from constitutional court decisions from the Russian Constitutional Court and supporting, accepting their logic and supporting them. But even though the Constitutional Court in Russia had ruled in favor of these groups, the bureaucracy was refusing to re-register the groups and allow them to function, and the European Court entered the fray. I just illustrated this point, that some of these partnerships with constitutional courts and national court systems has resulted in a strong support for some basic rights. Now, let's talk about courts as third-party partisans. Can the court actually start ruling in favor of a religious group and use them for their own purposes, perhaps? Jehovah's Witness cases offer some support for this theory, I think. In the United States in the 1930s and 40s, the witnesses have won 50 cases before the United States Supreme Court. The last one is recently, it's just a few years ago, on similar kinds of topics, the right to distribute literature, proselytize, that sort of thing. But my point about the courts becoming third-party partisans to advance their own agenda, they use these cases and some other cases involving minority religions to firmly establish the right of freedom of association, freedom of speech, and freedom of religion. If you take common law in America, you read these cases involving minority religions, and several of them are witness cases. Same thing happened in the 1950s, 10 years later, in Canada, with the Jehovah's Witnesses winning several key decisions and helping establish rights of freedom of religion, press and assembly, and they even won a successful suit in the High Court in Canada against the Premier of Quebec. More on this. They've also won many cases before the European Court of Human Rights in Council of Europe countries, starting in the early 90s, Kokkinakis, and continuing to present. From 1964 through August of 2013, a total of 209 witness cases were filed with the court from many countries. They've won outright 30 cases, and they've had 26 friendly settlements to date. A friendly settlement is when the nation basically gives up and changes the law or does something that will allow the court to not have to handle the case. They've lost two cases, five are withdrawn. That's an amazing record that rivals what occurred in America and in Canada. Currently, the witnesses have over 100 cases. They actually have 101 cases they filed with the European Court of Human Rights, most of them from Eastern and Central European countries. These cases, the ones they've won in friendly settlements include registration or re-registration, taxation cases, censorship of materials, freedom of expression, proselytizing, child custody, deportation, confidentiality of medical records, neutrality of the state, conscientious objection, very important there, and meeting disruptions and the right to have a place to worship. That's a pretty good record. Even France finally lost three Article 9 cases in 2011 involving the witnesses and a couple of other groups, the Amis and an evangelical group. The French authorities had attempted to put them out of business using tax law. And I could give details about that, but time is limited. I can tell you later if you want. They were trying to tax them out of existence. And the court, it took them 8 years, by the way, to get around to saying this. It's just, you get the impression the European Court of Human Rights hates to rule against France, their home, where the court is, or against original members on Article 9 cases. Here's a summary that I was talking about. 1, 30, 26, lost 2, inadmissible 69. Most of those have to do with conscientious objection cases that once they decided it, they didn't want to admit others and they left it to the court system of the nation to straighten out. Here are the Jehovah's Witness cases won before the European Court of Human Rights by country. 7 from Turkey, all of them dealing with conscientious objection. Turkey hasn't gotten the message. Greece, 3, conscientious objection, right to worship, freedom of expression. Russia, 4. I said 6. I think it's 6. This number may be some of the other cases didn't involve Jehovah's Witnesses, Salvation Army and Scientology. Austria, 6. France, 3. Armenia, 4. And Georgia, 3. Those are the cases they've won. Here are the pending cases from Central and Eastern Europe before the European Court of Human Rights. Armenia, 36, we'll come back to that in a moment. Azerbaijan, 22, Bulgaria, 1, Georgia, 3, Nagorno, I had to look that up and figure out what it was, 1. 2, Russia has 28 cases, and more are coming because of the insistence by Russian authorities that the witnesses' literature is terroristic, and they put it on lists and whatnot. Those cases will be very interesting to watch. Serbia, 1, Transnistria, had to look that one up too, Turkey, 2, and the Ukraine, 5. So that's, oh, back up to Armenia. I've been in contact with the legal department at the in Brooklyn of the witnesses. They've been very helpful. And he pointed out to me that those 36 cases involve 24 conscientious objection cases, but the issue has already been decided. And those cases are before the court still to decide on the damages that are to be awarded to the plaintiffs. So quickly, some conclusions. Courts form partnership with other courts under certain conditions that can promote the authority of the courts as well as human and civil rights, including religious freedom. It's worth noting conditions can change dramatically. Think of what's happened since the 90s in Hungary. Courts can partner with willing plaintiffs to advance the court agendas, which may include religious freedom, and even appear partisan towards such plaintiffs. If you read all those witness cases, by the way, they say some very nice things about the witnesses and their right to exist, and they get upset at governments that are impeding that. So you get the impression they must like the witnesses, which has certain ironies, if I may say. Such interactions between courts and between court systems and willing plaintiffs lead to changes in the authority, purview, and functioning of the courts. But, and here's a big but, it also contributes to changes in the religious group. If a religious group wants to go to court, they have to abide by the decision. So you better be ready to deal with whatever the court says. And it decisions with the witnesses and with other minority religious groups have indeed changed the way they function. There are illustrations or examples of changes in practice and theology that you can trace directly from court decisions. For instance, with the Christian Science cases in America is a case in point. Then one quick look at some conclusions on those jurisprudential theories we talked about. It is very clear that the European Court of Human Rights has been protective of the right of religious groups to exist and function, as shown by the number of cases, most from newer Council of Europe members, but then France, with its effort to put three religious groups out of business using tax provisions, the European Court finally said, enough is enough. We have to be somewhat consistent here. And so they ruled against France in 2011 on those three cases. But it's also been protective of some important individual religious rights: conscientious objection, proselytizing, child custody, privacy, and most of those came from the newer members. There is a recent case out of the UK about wearing a cross on a necklace of a flight attendant that was a win for that particular person, a controversial case to be sure. The issue of what values, secularization and or Christian, prevail in European Court of Human Rights decision is open for debate with critics on all sides. But I would suggest to you, and I don't have time to really go into it, that some European Court of Human Rights decisions, both positive and negative decisions, will lend support to this theory. And I would particularly, in closing, just mention things like putting a crucifix on a school wall, or how does that contrast with never ruling in favor of a decision about headgear and facial coverings? That and similar or analogous cases seem to me raise some questions about the last point. There's some references that if any of you are interested, again, I'll send you this, and that's it. I quit.